Welcome to A New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experiences within different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. So this is a fun one for me. I mean, they're all fun, but this is also extra fun for me. We've got Andre, and I'm going to say Andre B. Pronounce your last name for us.
Bolakowski.
Okay, see, when you say it, it's not that hard. When you see it in writing, it's like, how the world do you say that? Let me give just a little bit of background to our listeners. I don't want to say a whole lot because I'd like for Andre's story. But he is the founder and CEO of Provision Group. He is a developer in the Pacific Northwest, doing some amazing things in affordable housing and some other stuff. But I think more importantly than that, he and I have become dear friends. He is Russian. My wife is 50% Russian. And so there's just a connection there that Shelley doesn't have the opportunity to meet as many Russians. And so that's just fun from a heritage standpoint. And then you and I went to the same college. So we'll touch base on that. And we don't talk about investing on here. I mean, we generally, but we don't talk about any specific deals. But full transparency, I actually will be investing in a project that Andre is doing. One, because I believe in the project, and two, because I want to be associated with him and believe in him. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So start off, where are you located right now?
I'm in Vancouver, Washington. I used to have to say Portland, Oregon, but Vancouver's on the map now, baby. So I'm going to say it.
Yeah, and here's the funny thing. He knows that I used to live in Lake Oswego, was down in Eugene and Roseburg. So the funny thing is what you're saying is Vancouver, Washington has a better name right now than Portland?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We're on the Washington side, no income tax. But other than all of that is we're safe and we're clean and we're thriving.
All right. So do this for us. Give the listeners just a high level view of, you know, where you grew up. I mean, we'll get in depth on this, but just high level and up to what you're doing today.
Parents immigrated from Russia when I was 4 years old, grew up here in Vancouver. It was a small town, I think of maybe 100,000. Parents were working really hard morning to night there was five of us siblings to support us and to get into a house. And 2008, they lost it all. We grew up as kids poor, so our parents couldn't afford us to get anything. So if we wanted a pair of shoes or some t-shirts, we had to make it. So mowing lawns, selling Pokemon cards, knocking on doors or whatever we did it. I did it from when I was, you know, as early as I can remember. Kids were playing soccer, basketball. I was hustling something. And then at 2008, at that point, I was, I think, 18 or 19. Right before that, I left the house and I was on construction sites, hiring crews and sending them out to contractors in the new construction space. And because it made me an income that most adults made. I dropped out of school, so that was the 10th grade for me. And then 2009 hit, everything went down. I already had the debt and lifestyle I wanted to sustain. And that's when I started selling drugs. It started with OxyContins. OxyContin seemed like a pretty safe and non-painful, scary thing, but they got really expensive. They began to be controlled. The FBI got on the case, and then we moved into heroin. And then we were obviously became users and in and out of jail for 5 years of my life from the late teens to the early 20s. I was in disciplinary segregation and in a jail cell in solitary confinement where at this point I'm suicidal. I hate my life. I try to change. Nothing's happening. It's not working. I keep falling into that rut and I'm reading the Bible because it's the only thing that's there. You know, you get fed through a slot. You don't see the sunlight. You don't know what time it is. Days go by. Your mind's going crazy. And then there's this Bible there. So I'm opening up this Bible. I'm reading it as if for the first time, even though I knew the Bible as a kid, grew up in like Sunday school, but I didn't have the right idea of God, nor did I want to have anything to, in a sense, I was afraid of him. I didn't want to spend time with him or be seen by him. But at that time, when the Bible was there, I had no choice. I opened up the New Testament, reading Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and I couldn't put it down because of how much hope and how much light it was giving me. And at that time, man, I was tormented. So being able to just get a relief from the demons and the darkness that was inside of me was refreshing. And as I was reading, I saw God in a whole new light. And I noticed that he actually hung out with people like me rather than shying away from me. I also noticed that whoever came to him, whatever they needed, he gave them. He didn't reject even one person, which was surprising because I thought he worked on a hierarchical earning system, right? And then finally, I was looking for what do they do to deserve it? What do they do to get there, to earn it, to get it? And I found by the end of the gospel is that they didn't do anything. And that's when I realized, heck, I qualify. And that's when I fell on my knees and said, Lord, well, I need freedom from the addiction. And that's all I wanted. Really, that's all I needed, because you can't live if you're addicted to heroin. There's just no way. You're a walking zombie and you destroy everything and everyone around you. So I fell on my knees. I asked the Lord for that. And man, he set me free. It was done. It's been probably what? Let's see. I was 22. I'm 36, 14 years. I've never had a desire, not even like a creeping one, nothing. I've been completely set free. I got out of jail and I joined an organization called God Will Provide. They opened up rehab centers. So addicts would come in. They'd introduce them to Jesus. They'd walk out some things with them in life and send them out to open up more rehab centers. I did that for a little bit. And then I went to school where I got a full ride scholarship in Wheaton College. That was a miracle. And maybe I'll get to that a little bit later. But I had a chance to go through Wheaton College and get my bachelor's degree. Parallel to that, and after that, I started developing and building. And that's where I am today. I got 4 kids. I got an amazing wife. And we call Washougal, Washington, which is like a suburb of Vancouver, our home. And we're just getting started.
So clearly you lack energy and enthusiasm. I'm like all fired up just hearing you talk. So real fast, I want to drill on maybe 2 things. One, prior to going to jail, what would have been your view of God? We'll just start there. I mean, did you want nothing to do with him, or did you even know about him?
Well, it turns out I actually read a ton of the Bible as a kid. My mom told me that later. I completely forgot. Heroin wiped out a lot of my memory. So my mom told me I would read the Bible all the time. It seems that I did know him in some way. I grew up in a very traditional, very conservative Baptist church up here. And I should say this. All churches are amazing, and all churches have things that need to be worked on. I had the wrong idea of God, because to me, he seemed like a buzzkill. Like, everything that's Christian is boring. Everything that's godly is lame. Like, the vision of Christianity is like, survive, don't sin, don't do bad things, and get rescued into heaven one day, because it's all about eternity. Everything here will burn. Can't have nice stuff, can't, you know, desire anything. And so I had the wrong idea of God.
Thank you for sharing that. So let me go to, because I was with you, whatever it was, let's just say 6-8 weeks ago, I was getting ready to speak, and you had a young man because you were going to listen, and you happened to have a young man with you, and you were mentoring him, and I don't want to divulge any of his story, but it was fascinating. You're like, he just needs some wins. And so just give us, if you can, if it's okay, give us a snippet, because what you said for this guy to do to a person who's not been addicted to drugs, I'm like, how good advice that is. And then yet it was phenomenal advice.
Oh, man, bro, I wish I remembered what I told him.
Well, I will tell you, because it was this idea of you want him to start experiencing some wins. And so I think you told him something like, just stop vaping for 6 hours. And I'm like, what's the magic of stopping vaping for 6 hours? That ring a bell, what we talked about?
In my life, personally, like with heroin, you can't just stop for a day, gain some momentum, stop the second day. Heroin was one of those diseases where, I mean, if you get addicted to it, 90% chance you'll never get out of it. So 90% of people die from the disease, right? And so in that, with some things in life, I truly believe that it has to be only a spiritual experience. You can teach people how to think a certain way, how to get out of the improper stinking thinking. And that's a term you probably heard, especially in recovery. But with heroin, as AA says, once you're an addict, always an addict. See, I don't believe that. I say, once you're an addict, you're always an addict unless Jesus. And so if you want to be free, Jesus is the only way with a lot of these. There are people that I encounter left and right that have habit issues, addiction issues that they don't think they can get out of because they've tried so often. And it's that story, if you've heard, I'm sure many of the listeners have, where there's an elephant, it's large, and there's a stick with a rope, right? And the elephant doesn't go anywhere because it's a little stick. And the question is, well, can't he just yank that stick out with a little jerk? And the answer is he can. But why doesn't he? Because when he was a little elephant, the stick was big. And so he tried to yank it out as a little guy and couldn't. So now he thinks that stick will hold him. So same thing. A lot of times people get into these little ruts and they can't get out of these habits, these whatever it may be for them. And this guy, he had a lot of issues. But there was one easy apple, easy thing that he could grab where he could create some momentum, something that was bothering him. And that was vaping. The guy was vaping and he couldn't get out of it. And so my advice to him was, hey, listen, look, man, can we start you off by making you 1% better in 1 week? People, when they want to get out of something, they try to go cold turkey or they try to change 10 things about themselves, but likely not going to happen. But if you start by just one little thing in 1 week, next week you add that little thing, you create momentum, your mind starts believing that it can do it, and slowly you actually are 50% better from the year before. Now, a 50% change is a drastic change. But it takes 1% a week for 52 weeks. And so that's what I told him. I said, what can you do? And he said, well, I have to vape every 2-3 hours. I'm like, well, what can you do? If you want to quit, what would be the number? So we started off with like 6 hours. Well, I've done this with a few different guys. And out of the 4 different guys that I've talked to and have done this with, usually within 2-3 weeks, they completely quit. Like they get free from something they've tried to do, try to get free from for years, you know, 2, 3, 5 years. They know they have to call me in a week. They have to report that I'm going to hold them accountable. And usually after they do 6 hours, they think, heck, I can do 12. Well, then after 12, I can do 18, 36. And then all of a sudden they quit. Right. That was the advice.
Well, it's interesting to me. I mean, I think there's 2 lessons that I hear. One is these little victories. And then 2 is the power of the mind. And it can take you amazing places in a positive way, or can take you unfortunately, in a really dark place. Okay, so today you're a successful developer. Just tell us a little bit about why you're a developer, and then what are some of the things, I don't even know about the specific projects, but generically, what type of things are you developing?
The term affordable housing oftentimes is coupled with, and I'm not sure how true this is for the rest of the country, but in our region, it's coupled with grant money. It's coupled with financial tax breaks, different waivers, and oftentimes DEI programs and points that you have to get to by certain ownership structures and diversity of employees that are in the firm. I don't have any of that. So I would say, technically, I'm not building affordable housing. I actually build middle income housing or workforce housing, which is essentially affordable for a median income family, where in our area, a median income is about $90,000. What we try to build is anywhere from $300,000 to $500,000 for a house, right? So we build some attached, some detached. Mostly the goal is detached because it's a better lifestyle. There is a huge, you know, Portland has been on the headlines for a while now. And one of our tallest buildings in downtown Portland just closed at 20 cents on the dollar. Portland's been suffering in terms of commercial space and in real estate, right? So, I mean, even in residential. But for a housing that is median income, is still hard for people to acquire. And so we, in the last 5 years, have been writing this code change that Portland's been doing and now Vancouver is doing as well. And we've been developing a product that is smartly designed, still efficient at cost to build, and at the same time, it could still turn a profit. So people ask, how can you guys turn a profit in Vancouver, Portland, when you're selling a unit at $350,000, which some of our products are? Well, it's because we don't build in a commercial code going up. We build townhome style, 2-story, 2-bedroom, 3-bedroom, 2.5-bath with small yards, no parking. So if you divide the land cost, the GC fees, and all of the costs that are associated with it, and we do this all in-house, meaning we go through the entitlements, we draft our own projects, we build out our own products. So at the end of the day, the cost between all that still allows us to build something that people can afford and still turn a profit. I'm sorry, I forgot where you were going with the question. I just wanted to kind of explain what we do.
That's what I'd ask. And then the other thing is, what's your why behind this? Why are you doing this?
It sounds really cliche, man. It sounds really cliche, but I was at church yesterday, and you know, we were worshiping, and man, I can't. There is no bigger why for me right now than just giving back to him for what he did for me. I have everything I need, man. Like the cars, the watches, the vacations, the house, he's given me everything. Like, I remember being in jail and asking for one thing. Can I just stop being addicted? And then after I got free, I was like, can I get my license back? Because I was suspended for 10 years. I didn't, you know, I was getting out of jail on an anchor bracelet suspended for 10 years, right? How can you live and do anything without a car, right? Or a driver's license. So he's done over and abundantly, insanely, something I couldn't ever wrap my head around, right? And so, you know, I have a degree, which, by the way, God gave me a full ride scholarship of Wheaton College, where usually I'm disqualified everywhere I go with my record of full multiple felonies and drop out from the 10th grade. Yeah, I get into one of the nicest Christian flagship universities in America. because of that. And then, you know, I have a family, an amazing wife, four beautiful children. You know, I built an orphanage in Bangladesh and I had a chance to actually do something really cool. Who gets to do that? You know, I have a house on a river. I have a boutique little development firm with a bunch of amazing team members. What's the why? What else could it be? It's either to become cooler and more powerful and have more money, but like, how lame is that, right? Like, at the end of the day, the why is like, man, God, what can I do that would just, I know I can't pay him back, right? But like, what can I do to show you that I love you? And to me, the answer's simple. It's build his kingdom. In my specific life and my gift set, I know that I am not going to do it exactly the same way that you would, Jeff, or any other listener, because he's created me in a different way. So I try to look at where the need is. I try to look at what my passion is, where my experience and my unique ability and my gift set is, and I try to tie those three together. And real estate and developing real estate here locally so happens to be where those intersect. The need, my passion, my experience, and my unique ability. So that's why I do what I do.
Yeah, and I've traveled around and you've sent me around all these different projects, which I love. And it's very clear. You love the work, you love the why, you love your team, you love, providing housing to people. And then I think my two cents is you love to be able to find these little niche codes and things to find a competitive edge for you to make a difference, which ultimately makes a difference. You put more houses on there and get people housing. When you were talking, I felt like I just need to say this to you personally, because as you're talking, I really meant this. Number one, it's an honor to be a Wheaton College graduate with you. And part of the reason why it's an honor is you went to school under a Colson scholarship, which is that part of Wheaton is where I was introduced to prison ministry. So it is so cool to 34, 35 years ago, whatever it was when I was there. No, I mean, that's when I was a freshman, sorry, to be friends with a Colson scholar. And for the record, I don't even think of you as a Colson scholar, but when I hear you talk about it, I'm like, ah. The second thing I think is really powerful in my line of work, and you already said this, if you came to me and we wanted to work together, or you wanted us to take what you're doing to some of our advisors, the natural knee-jerk response is, wait, you were in jail? No, I'm going to tear it up, rip it up. It's disqualifying for what we do. And so that's not the way I feel about you. And in fact, the right people, which can be anyone, who get humbled and get brought up are frankly the people you want to invest with. Your perspective on life, you've had to completely surrender, as does all of us, whether we have to go by behind bars or not. We got our own bars. So it's funny when I think about this as I'm listening to you play this story out. On one hand, you're like, oh my gosh, why would you invest with this guy? And it's like, no, a reformed guy is exactly who I want to invest with, because you're doesn't mean you have to be, but I know you, your motives, your desire for there to be success, hopefully for the right reasons, I'm going to throw my chips on guys like you. And like I said, I'm no different than you. In fact, the difference is I just never got caught. And by the grace of God, I never got caught up in drugs, but I got my own sin and stuff as well. So anyways, it's been an honor to be able to say I'm a Wheaton grad with you. It's also an honor to say that I'm investing in some of your projects.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Okay, so you're, what'd you say, 30, you say 36?
Yeah, I'm 36, yeah.
How would you best describe who you are in the context of where you're at in your life journey? So let's just assume you're less than halfway through your life. Yeah, let's definitely assume that. Who are you in this context of this greater journey that you think you're on or believe you're on?
Yeah, I'll be honest. I feel like I'm just getting started. And I'll probably say that when I'm like 75 and I'll still be doing a million things and, you know, not sleeping. But really, man, like when I think of the past 14 years after I got out of jail and what I used to think was possible, right? And what I could even just fathom or wrap my head around, I'm finally starting to see something bigger, something that could impact the world, right? Or my local region. We've built and sold over 400 units. We have 300 units in the pipeline. That's still nothing for when I think of impact, right? But when I say I feel like I'm just getting started, I think that if the gift that I could give to people is to invest into the next generation, the Gen Zers, to see the power of impactful businesses. So if I can build 300 units or even 600 units, okay, well, who cares? Well, not who cares. It could be 300 households. It could be 300 families. It could be 300 families with, you know, 2-3 kids each that would give them the pride of owning something and caring about their property. But what if we were to help other people dream to create businesses that would impact the world? Well, now we've just reproduced that 300 times 300, right? And so I get passionate about transferring this mindset to the younger generation. And personally, I've met, and I used to think that the Gen Zers are just, man, they're a dangerous, like lazy, whatever stigmaed generation. But I have found that they're actually geniuses. They don't like the fakeness and they want to cut through the noise. And they're looking for what matters, what's real, what works. And they're looking for impact. They want to matter. They want their lives to matter. So if I could do something more to impact them, that's what I would love to do.
Great answer. And I knew that about you, but I wouldn't have. It was interesting that you articulated that in the context of, you know, where you're at. So it definitely gives me a vision of why you and I are talking about some of the things that we've been talking about. So I'm assuming one of the questions I normally ask is how you're trying to change the world, but I almost think you just answered that question. Let's switch over to the idea of capital, because look, we all have capital, whether it's human capital, relational capital, or money. And you have all of those, and at times you've not had all of them, as does all of us. So when did you realize the power of capital, whatever you want capital to mean, and what does that mean to you?
The problem is I haven't realized the power of capital. And let me be completely straightforward, right? I realized the power of God. I realized that over and over and over and over again, starting from when he set me free from heroin in like this, to when he got me into Wheaton, to when he got me into my first real estate deal, to when he walked with me in raising $1 million for an orphanage in Bangladesh across the world at with 2012 and 13, a year after getting out of jail, to when throughout my life in business, you know, I stepped out of the boat, so to say, cleaned out the account, gave everything away, and then said, Lord, like, what now? And he would come through over and over again. So a lot of developers in Portland have gone under. A lot of developers have lost hundreds of thousands of dollars on deals. We haven't lost money on any deal. We haven't had a non-profitable deal, which I can't even take for granted. I mean, that's no matter how smart you are, when real estate, when our asset class in Portland went more than 30% down, when we were selling units at 400, 420, to then selling the same units at 270, 280, that's a huge downturn. Now, the fact that we still made profit, that was God. You know, somehow he'd give me wisdom, give me a connection, send in the buyers, bring in that subcontract, whatever. But we've done a ton of deals and we've never lost money. And so when I say I don't know the power of capital, but I know the power of God, I mean that. But I see the usefulness of capital, right? Like, I understand that he does everything through community. When I say he, I mean God, right? I understand that he can do it all himself. Like this, with this word, right? He did. He created it. Now he entrusts people like you and me and so many others. And he says, work together and collectively with your gifts, with your characters, with your capitals, build cool things and build my kingdom here on earth. When I look at capital, I look at his structure. That's his way. He's not going to, I can do a lot of things. You can do a lot of things, but the family aspect, the aspect of interdependency is his way. And so because it's his way, I see power being exuded through that. And so if we were to just say capital is money, if you were to ask me, hey, when did I realize the power of money or business, for example, I would say personally, it's been a journey to realize the value of capital, the value of money. I grew up in this traditional thought process that God only cares about eternity and only cares about souls, and it's all about evangelizing and preaching the gospel. I didn't really set value to capital or money. But when in the last 5 years, I have noticed how money liberates people to create good. Money allows me to dream, to do great things. It allows me to spend time with my kids because I'm not a slave from the 8 to 5, and I can actually love on my children, spend time with them and be a dad to them. It creates health. It creates, I mean, you name it. God isn't just about eternity, he's about this world. He loves this world. So, and he's all about abundance too, in capital, in relationships, in finance, in money. So his design of the kingdom and the way we are called to live requires an abundance of capital. So yeah, I guess maybe that's philosophical, but yes, there's definitely extreme power in capital, right? We all know it.
What I love, you're talking about a positive side of that, which is wonderful. And I, unfortunately, I also see out there in the world how, if used wrong, capital can be destructive towards others, destructive towards self, all those kind of things. This word stewardship, I don't know if it's a word that you use a whole lot, or you do, but what does stewardship mean to you?
A lot of people will say, God owns everything, we're just stewards. I would kind of disagree with that. And not because I have a small view of what he owns. I mean, it's clearly all his, but I would say we're co-owners with him. When he entrusts us with something, he does give it to us as possessions, but we're co-owners with him. We still answer to him. I remember when I just got married within the first year, I was just spending some time with the Lord and I was praying, and his presence came into the room. I haven't experienced him like this before or after, where it was just the fear of God came into the room. And I remember the Holy Spirit had to have been the Holy Spirit. And he just gave me like a word of knowledge. He downloaded this phrase into my mind. And he said, hey, you're married to my daughter. And don't you dare hurt her, because I'm going to ask of you. And so I remember that experience, because I'm a very like, let's go, I'm loud, I'm energetic. And so, you know, sometimes I can hurt people. Now God, he straight told me. And so when I think of stewardship, I don't think of it as, oh, she's just God's daughter, I'm supposed to like just love her. No, she is my wife too. There's relationship there that's bigger. But again, stewardship to me is co-creating, co-building, co-owning. It's not just his, it's ours. I'm his son. I'm co-heir to what he's building, creation. I don't just treat it as an employee to a boss. I treat it as a co-partner that actually he is, right? Like he tells me what to do. He's gives me great ideas and I get to reap the benefits. I don't believe in God being that buzzkill, as I mentioned at the beginning, where I need to just think about eternity and everything, that I just need to give all my money away. I think of it as a relationship, meaning like he created me to enjoy this. He enjoys watching me enjoy it. I enjoy watching my kids enjoy the playground. So I try to live like that. I'll put it this way. Not a lot of people would agree with me when I would say this, but he's told me to clean out my account multiple times, starting from when I just got out of jail with having $2,000 for a restitution payment and bills, and told me to give that away. Or he didn't even tell me, he nudged me. He like invited me. He said, hey, there's this rehab center that's opening up. You can be part of that. And I remember just giving that first $2,000 away, which to me in 2013, that was everything I had, right? And when I did, he came through after. And then he did that a year later with 10 grand. And then he did that 6 months later with 30. And so he's done that with me over and over again. And he's proved to be faithful. When I did, he always came through and never let me fail or let me sink or let me miss a payment or put somebody else in jeopardy. So I completely believe in him being the boss, but I also, we're doing this together.
Just to clarify, is what you're talking about, how do you differentiate what you're talking about against the prosperity gospel?
I guess most people would think of prosperity gospel as you think about wealth and, you know, God's all about wealth and God wants you to be rich and God wants everybody to be healthy and everything has to be peachy and great. And if anything isn't, then that's not of God. Then is that how we would define prosperity gospel?
Yeah, that's how you define it.
How is my idea of God and abundance different? It's not too much different. So this is where some people get rubbed the wrong way. So people are like, are you a prosperity gospel preacher? No, not at all, because there's a difference. So prosperity gospel focuses on me. It says, Andre, you're supposed to be wealthy. You're supposed to be rich. You're supposed to be beautiful. You're supposed to be the. But see, when you love Jesus, it's not about you. You reap the benefit. See, I am so freaking loved. Like I am so taken care of that I don't have to worry about me anymore. I can actually now be free and be able to actually care about everybody around me. So that's the difference between my idea of an abundant God towards like prosperity gospel, because prosperity gospel focuses on me. God's idea of abundance focuses on others. Does that make sense?
No, it makes sense. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and love others of yourself. And that's the articulation of that. So, well, again, your passion oozes. That's why I love being around you. And you clearly are a person who has deep conviction and faith, but you equally match that with your actions. All the way from how when you feel called to give, you're going to give. You're going to give abundantly. When you were talking about this freedom, but when I was at your house last time, you've got these little four-wheelers and your kids were, now they had helmets on and they were zipping around with pure joy. And one of your children is very young. Now this very, she was not driving it, but the other child was. And actually, it is a great metaphor for how you live your life. You had your kids had helmets on, but there was freedom that you were giving them to explore and to go have fun. And yeah, if one of them fell off, probably going to be fine. These are small little things. They got the helmets on. But I think a lot of people thought, as did I, I'm like, oh my gosh, what are you doing? But it really is a metaphor where you're like, I'm going to live hard. I'm going to live smart, but I'm going to live hard. That's a great image that as you're talking, I'm like, yep, that exemplifies your family and the way that they live. Hopefully that is a positive thing for you. I don't mean it to be. It is a positive thing. And there's nothing disparaging. But your kids were, oh my gosh, they were loving being on a four-wheel. And in fact, this has come from a guy. My dad was a physician. And I dreamed every day when we lived out in the country that I would come home and there'd be a nice new little dirt bike there for me to ride. Never happened because he worked in the emergency room. So I think your story resonates with me even more because of that. So, okay, last question. If you could have any dream come true, what would it be? And if it's helpful, I'll take the family unit out of the picture because obviously we all want healthy, you know, kids and to see their kids. But if that's what you want to say, and that's then say that.
Honestly, there's one thing that moves me on earth like nothing else other than being grateful for what he did and spending time with him is my kids, man. Like, that's a dream. I dream of my kids and my grandkids being with me, being around me, we crushing life together, building businesses, changing the world, building orphanages, whatever it may be, all together, right? Like a happy family. There is no other dream, man. Like, I wish I could say, you know, my dream is to build like 1,000 houses. That's easy, man. Okay, what else? Like 100 orphanages? That's easy too. But like transferring this over to the next generation, man, seeing the next generation, whether that's my kids or just honestly just the next generation to do better than we did, which by the way is easy because I feel like the millennials, we're not doing too good. But man, the future to be better, the people to be more real. Yeah, that's the dream, is watching them succeed.
Well, that is an amazing dream. And I don't know any parent. Well, I hope I don't know any parents that wouldn't have that same dream. I just hope culturally we start putting the necessary things in place so that whatever that means, so that families can flourish. And unfortunately, I'm not so sure the families are flourishing. I mean, there clearly are families who are first flourishing, but my work in the prison system, you just see there's a very unfortunate family breakdown. And you see it inside the prison system and you see it, frankly, outside of it. So, well, I love your passion for your kids, and it is evident that you love your wife dearly and your kids dearly. So anything you want to say in closing?
No, man. I apologize.
You don't have to. You know, as your friend, I commend you. I don't have to say this to you because you'll do it anyways, but continue to push hard, continue to make a difference. Fun to just see how you've grown, even in Vancouver, from relationships, from, you know, all the way up into those that have real influence in the community. You know, the work that you're doing is attracting attention. You're putting your fingerprint on Vancouver, and you're making Vancouver a better place. Honored to be associated with you, and look forward to many years being involved with your life. For those, thank you so much for joining. Don't forget to subscribe to A New Lens with Common Good Capital on your podcast app of choice. Until next time, have a wonderful week or 2 weeks. We'll see how quickly we get another one recorded. But until then, later.
Thank you.
This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk.
including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.